The From Day One podcast is brought to you by The Bridge and the Made in New York Media Center.
Hi, I'm Nick Bailey, and this is the From Day One podcast. Today I'm joined by Megan Ritchie, owner and founder behind the popular artisanal hand pastries known as Meg Pies. Fans of baked sweets may recognize the name from their local Starbucks counter, where Meg Pie's signature Pop-Tart-like squares have been sold nationwide since July of 2016. With a thriving partnership with an empire like Starbucks, it's hard to imagine Ritchie just 5 years ago balancing odd jobs and selling her baked creations from her stoop in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Ritchie spent the first 2 years of the business in an endless cycle, waitressing, acting jobs, midnight scone batches, and making early morning bike deliveries while commuting to her day job at a jam kitchen. Before long, Ritchie took on a partner, Paul Jones, to help with deliveries and sales, and moved from a home kitchen to a commercial space, thanks to growing demand for the tasty products. Today, Meg Pies is a successful operation with multiple facilities, including one still here in Brooklyn. Since the Starbucks partnership launched, Meg Pies has produced millions of pies to fill the shelves at over 7,500 locations, as well as Whole Foods stores and countless local and regional shops and cafes. Meg, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So I take it you're no longer baking them yourself.
I'm not anymore, no.
Tell us a little bit about what your day is like these days.
Very different from what it started out as. So now I mostly handle all of the administrative tasks, so everything involved in running the day-to-day business of things. So a lot of my day consists of sitting on my living room couch on a laptop. Very different from getting up and doing a lot of manual labor and baking every tart and icing all the tarts. Just filling in on, you know, the holiday season when they get really busy. I've worked in countless restaurants, so I've always been in the food business in that way. And then my parents are big cooks and bakers, so for all of our family gatherings, they made the pies and cakes. My stepdad makes a really great pie. He owned a restaurant at one point.
So, here in New York?
No, in Bainbridge Island, Washington.
Okay.
So I think I was just always around it and always around people who liked to craft their own, you know, creations. So that definitely influenced me, but I wasn't classically trained or anything like that.
Sure. And so when did you start to get the inkling that you would want to sell something that you'd baked instead of just eating it yourself?
It's a funny story. My roommate and I, at the time, probably in 2006, I think, or 2007, made donuts out of pizza dough. We just went and bought pizza dough and fried them up. Anybody in New York who goes to street fairs has had Zeppelis, so it's exactly the same. And we made those for a brunch, and we said, these are so good, we should sell them on our stoop. Just, you know, ha, 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 like a joke. And we thought, you know, why not? It's a great way to be outside during the summer and see our neighbors. We live on a block that had a coffee shop on the corner, but then nothing between us and the subway. So we thought that'd be a great place to just, you know, see if people liked what we made. So we started with the pizza dough donuts, and then we developed our own dough and our own fillings. And we made like a lavender glaze and really wonderful, gorgeous donuts. And we would sell those on our stoop once a week. And we had an email list of people who would stop by. And we had a lot of regulars, people who that was their commute either to the subway or to school. So that's really how it started, selling our own stuff. And then we got busy with life and work and stopped doing that. And I started Meg Pies as trying to get back to that a little bit, just something to do with my time that wasn't my jobs. And it's so enjoyable. I mean, it's wonderful to be on the stoop and talk to people every morning and people watch. I mean, it's a really wonderful experience, and I'm super
being part of the Brooklyn street
that.
Life, right?
Yeah, it's wonderful, and I actually miss that more than anything else.
So now, in some ways, this story is sort of like the classic American dream. You know, you have a lemonade stand that becomes, you know, an international or a national enterprise, right? I mean, I think a lot of people hear that story and are interested. What are some of the things that you've got to think about? I mean, obviously there's a transition. I mean, is it legal to sell food? I mean, what are the rules? Like, how do you get started doing something like that when you want to take it seriously?
Sure. I'm pretty sure that everything we did was illegal. But because we were so small scale and it's not really that much of an infraction on anybody, it wasn't a big deal. I mean, I don't even know if we made that much profit off of what we were selling. It all stayed in a cigar box, and we used it for grocery shopping for the next week that we did it. So I think because it wasn't like a huge operation, we were kind of left alone. I mean, it helps that we were in a neighborhood that is that embraces that kind of stuff. I don't know that it would work everywhere, but I'm sure it was not elite. I'm sure it was not legal. And then certainly when I took it a little bit beyond the stoop and I said, you know what, I want to deliver these to cafes and see if I can make this a business, I just wanted to stop waitressing. Like, I really wanted an ability to get out of that. So baking them in my house and then delivering them to cafes was totally illegal. And then I just worked as fast as I could to make it legal once I knew that I had sort of a proof of concept. So I always encourage people to try things as much as they possibly can and push that limit. Even if it's just selling to your friends or if you're concerned about being, you know, legal or not legal, doing whatever you can to test your product and have people taste it is really important. I am someone who will get very, mired in the details. And if I wanted to actually start a company, like I said to myself, I'm going to start this company, I would have never started it. It would have taken me forever to get something perfect to go out there. But because this was just a means to an end, like a way to sort of change my what I was doing in my everyday life, and I didn't ever think it was going to be a real business, I was able to just put a product out there and then continue to improve it and get feedback from people, which in hindsight now I would say is the best way to start something. Because if you're trying to put a perfect product out there, you're, you know, late to the game.
Sure. It's what a lot of software companies call the lean startup sort of methodology, right?
Yeah.
A minimum product and you just get started. What are some of the early challenges that you have in dealing with food specifically? Food, of course, is perishable. What are some of the things you got to think about when you're starting out?
I mean, we have endless issues with perishability in our product. If I were doing it again today, knowing what I know, I would definitely pick a different product to make. But this is the one product that I made that really resonated with people. So that's why it became successful. So you can't plan those things. But, we still, to this day, work a lot on that sort of stuff. So we're constantly recipe testing and working on ways that we can increase our shelf life without making it an unnatural product. So you can look at some sort of natural brands of toaster pastries, and they are natural, and sometimes they're organic, but they still have, 36 ingredients, and that's so that they can be shelf stable, or they have a lot of apple filler in their filling instead of just strawberries or, something like that. All of that is for a reason. Our pastry is baked and then finished and then frozen immediately, like flash frozen, so that it can be shipped across the country and then thawed for consumers. And the reason that we do that is because you're getting the pastry in its freshest state and it's good for, a certain number of days. It can, go stale, just like any sort of pastry can. So working on this scale, selling, nationally, makes that a huge challenge. So I'm constantly working with, different cold storage facilities and all that sort of stuff. So it started, I would bake every single day and then you don't worry about those things. And then now it's on a scale where you worry about those things a little bit more. So all of my sort of worries about the food science of things and learning about those things have changed over time. But it's always a concern, just trying to keep it an all butter crust and not put anything in it that isn't true to what that would be if you made it at home.
Sure. So now you're making pastries and people like them, which is an amazing development. What happens next?
Oh, I don't know. I've always just wanted to see where this goes. So because we didn't, set out and make a business plan in the beginning, our business plan, when we finally made it about 5 years in, was very focused on this deal with Starbucks, with them wanting to take it further, because that was the first time we had to seek funding. And we were able to find funding that didn't take any equity out of the company. So we're lucky that we still own 100% of our company. That gives us a lot of opportunity for the future. So ideally, we'll come out with a couple other products. We have two that are still somewhat in the concept phase, and things take a lot longer than I'd like at this stage. It's not just me making it in my kitchen and then being like, that's it, that's the recipe. So those things take a lot of time and take a lot of forethought, but ideally will be able to be found in a couple different places in your grocery store soon, not just in the pastry case. And sales-wise, we're just trying to grow beyond Starbucks now. So can you find us in your grocery store? And in New York City, that works well because we're local and we can support that. But we're trying to grow that out regionally now.
So take me back a little bit. So when you're getting started, and you know you're selling to local cafes, right? Basically, you're sort of going hand in hand to the stores. At some point, you reach a tipping point where it starts to become a bigger business. How did that happen? Like, walk me through the steps.
That was really Paul. So Paul Jones, my partner, is also my boyfriend, was just sort of a supportive, you know, help at the beginning. If I needed ginger chopped for scones or I needed somebody to help me ice the tarts, he was there to help. And when I moved into a restaurant kitchen for the first time, I realized that it was really hard for me to both make everything within the time I was allowed to be in the kitchen and deliver at the same time because those two things overlapped. So I said, would you mind doing this for me? And he's not a morning person, I'll say, but he had to get up at like 5 a.m. to start the bike route to do that. And he did that for me, and he did it for about a month before he realized that there was a lot of positive feedback from the cafes we were working with. And he thought, you know, I could probably go to other cafes and sell more of these if you like. And I was like, well, you can try, but I feel like it's a, you know, we've got six cafes. That's a lot, you know.
What was his background? Was he in sales previously or something?
His family owns a printing company, and he had worked for them for a while, selling printing, making sure that, you know, he could take care of the New York clients because they're in Pennsylvania. So he had done that. And he had worked in advertising for a while as well. But he's an actor. He's a voiceover actor. He would be better at this than I am doing a podcast. I think the thing that makes him super talented, especially in our beginning of our business working with cafes, is that he's very personable and he had a really great strategy for going into cafes. He never asked for the manager and he never brought samples. He would go in, he just wanted to ask them, what sells well here? Would you like to try something like this? Do you think it would do well? Just to the people who work there day to day and are interacting with customers. And that really, I think, got him in the door in most places because he respected their opinion. And if it wasn't right for them, he wouldn't push it on them. But he sold to, the first place he ever sold them to was Stumptown, in the Ace Hotel on 28th Street, I think. And he came back that night and I remember him, he would tuck me into bed cause I'd go to bed at like 6 PM.
And the life of a baker.
Exactly. And he said, you know, hey, I sold to Stumptown. And I remember like bolting upright in bed and being like, but that's in Manhattan. How will you get them there? You know, like it just was beyond my ability to think, how would you bike them in? And he said, I'll just take them on the subway after. And he started doing that and he started to get more and more. And he grew our business from, I think in January of 2013, I was making about 300 tarts per week. And by August of that year, I was making 3,000 per week. And that was his
sales. Still by yourself
sales.
At this point.
Yeah, still by myself. I did have a good friend of mine who showed up twice a week, every week, for free and helped me in the kitchen in a basement of a restaurant after she dropped her son off at school. And I'm forever thankful for that help because I could not have done it without Paul selling and her helping me out.
Now, one of the challenges when you're growing that quickly is, you know, keeping up with the business. What were some of the challenges that you faced doing that?
In the initial days, it was mostly like, how do I get QuickBooks and how do I learn how to use it? You know, I remember my first invoices was a Word document where I like basically created a table that I thought looked like an invoice. I'd never seen one before. So it was all about learning. And then as we grew, it became, you know, okay, how do we get a agriculture and markets license for our kitchen? And then that grew to, you know, we started working with Whole Foods. How do we become a super legitimate business with insurance and all of the things that you needed for that to partner with those type of people and sell in their stores. And I will say that the Whole Foods packet of things that you need to do is almost like a how to start your business. And it was a great way for us to understand everything that was needed and do those things almost like a checklist.
No, a lot of people wonder, you know, how do you, the transition from like walking into a coffee shop and selling something to like working with these multinational corporations that seem, you know, opaque or impenetrable. You know, what's the first step? How do you get your foot in the door at a place like that?
I'll say that we were really lucky, and part of that is that we, you know, because we didn't have a plan, we never imagined that we would work with people like Whole Foods or Starbucks. We were discovered by Ellie Truesdell, who was the local forager at the time for Whole Foods, at our second weekend of Smorgasburg. So it was like a very early thing. I think we could have worked very fast to get into Whole Foods, but I really took the time to go through that packet of stuff and took about 6 months to really make sure that we were legally on the level and everything was being done correctly. We had to learn how to package our product. And so that was the very first one, and she kind of came to us, which was great. I'll say the biggest mistakes that I made in the beginning is I didn't know how much our product should cost, what our wholesale cost should be, and my costs were not based off of my actual costs. So despite the fact that, you know, you have to kind of come to a wholesale cost for grocers for it to work for them and work for the customers, that doesn't mean necessarily that you're making the money that you need to make. But when I was the only labor I was babysitting, I could kind of be okay with that. But figuring that out was definitely the hardest thing for us to do. And that came a little bit later. But and still to this day is, you know, how do we get it the right price for the customers is a big hurdle to jump. But that was a little off topic. But our Starbucks deal was also super lucky. Paul knew somebody who he went to school with all through elementary and high school. And she was working with QVC and asked if we wanted to go on QVC. And at the time, it didn't really work out because you have to produce a bunch of product and have it ready to ship. And because we're perishable, it just was a really big risk for us. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't afford it. So we didn't do that. And we thought, well, you know, maybe down the line we'll be able to do that. She did bring us in to meet with a couple people about how we would scale our business to do that. And one of those people left that position and moved into working with Starbucks and sort of coming up with a program of how do we bring in small businesses, how do we help those small businesses and also grow our snack offerings to people and in sort of a win-win situation. And he remembered us and luckily for us felt that packaged pastry wasn't going to be too big of a competition with their pastry case pastry. And started the process with us, and we started to test in about 30 New York City stores after that.
Now, there's a sort of an archetypal story among entrepreneurs of the business that like you know runs and grows for 10 or 15 years and is regional and is doing fine, has employees, and then all of a sudden they get on the radar of you know something like maybe Walmart or another large distributor or retailer. They get a huge order. They're rich. They feel like they're rich. Everything's great. And then like a year later, they're out of business. It's a very dangerous thing, right? What are those risks? Like, were you aware of the risks? And how do you finance growth like that, right? I mean, isn't it one of those situations where, you feel like you're getting a lot of money, but you actually end up sort of with less money than you started with? You know,
for a little while. Oh, it's 110% scary and scary to this day. Like, I'm always bracing myself for the fact that. Even though we have a great relationship with Starbucks, they could decide tomorrow not to carry us, you know. And that's right now a huge percentage of our business. So you think to yourself, well, can we survive if we don't have them? And we have just been really as cautious as we can be about our spending. So we made a lot of money last year. It was a windfall year because we had to fulfill a pipeline for thousands of stores. And it felt great, but I've always been a little bit almost too conservative with our business money. So we didn't get paid for, you know, I don't think Paul even got a paycheck for the first 2 years he worked for the company. I only got a paycheck while I was baking them, and it was not enough to survive. And even to this day, we pay ourselves like the bare minimum we can in order to contribute to our like retirement fund or whatever we possibly can like get that minimum in. And up until this July, we didn't have any employees. We work out of our apartment. We don't have any utilities that we pay for. We're super, super lean. And we just try to keep any of that money that we earned last year to invest in the bigger projects that we want to accomplish this year. So like, you know, those fulfilling that pipeline gave us cash that was able to produce more tarts that we can now try to sell regionally and build and get more accounts. And doing that is very expensive, like way more expensive than we could have imagined. There's marketing costs and, you know, chargebacks and all sorts of stuff that you never know about until you're in the middle of doing business. Those are the sorts of things that we try to spend our money on and not on sort of superfluous things as much as possible. And then we try just not to feel like, hey, we personally are rich or anything, because, you know, that makes it more scary, I think.
Were you able to finance your massive growth with sales, or did you take on financing?
Yeah, so we did get a financing company that came in. We were super ignorant of how you get funding. We had this sort of basis of an idea with Starbucks, and then we had some purchase orders. So we thought, oh, we'll just go to a bank and we'll say, here's these purchase orders for like 1 million tarts. Anybody will give us money, you know? Mm-hmm. And we walked into banks and it was like a big no. I mean, we might be able to give you an SBA loan for $35,000, but we're not going to give you $1 million. And to their credit, I mean, they did try to let me down as easy as possible and work with us in any way they could, but it just wasn't happening. And we were less than 2 weeks out of having to produce this stuff, which we pay for upfront. So one bank did know of a funding company, and they brought them in, and they said, well, we can fund this, but it's going to be factoring, which is expensive, an expensive loan, basically.
What is factoring?
They'll put up the money ahead of time, but your interest is going to be much higher than a bank. However, their interest was manageable. We knew we were only going to need that sort of initial loan for about 2 months in our business plan. And again, banks will look at that and say it was very risky. But to us, we were super confident. We were like, this is exactly how long we need it. We have payment terms. We knew when we were going to get paid.
And in some ways, banks are not interested in something that only lasts 2 months because they don't make much money, right?
Exactly. Yeah, they're not going to get as much out of it. So this funding company was great, and they partnered with us, and they said, okay, we'll fund this initial growth up to 1 million. When that money starts coming in, then you pay off those debts and you pay off the fees, and then everything else is yours. And then we'll continue with some AR funding. So we still work with them for AR funding. When a bill gets paid, they give us 75%
of that. AR is accounts receivable, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they give us 75% of the check that comes in, and then or of the invoice that we put out. And then when the check comes in, we get the remaining 25% minus fees. So they get to make a little bit of money off of financing us, but we get the cash up front, which just helps us continue to have cash flow. They were great, and we did, in fact, only need it for about 2 months, and it worked out for us. The other option was to find somebody who would maybe think that our business was worth $1 million and pretty much buy us out. I mean, get to the point where we had less than 50% of the business, and that was more scary because you get this big opportunity and you think, I do want to still have control of my company. I do want to decide its destiny. And giving up your whole company seemed a little bit scary. So we were lucky.
Your name's right on the package, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we were lucky we didn't have to do that. And it worked out. But, I mean, it was very tenuous at the time.
What are some of the challenges when you had to increase your team? Like, who did you hire for early on?
So we didn't hire anybody. It was just the two of us throughout the entire process until July 1st of this year. And we just brought on a team member.
So 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. So we just brought on a team member, Jill, who was my roommate, who started the donut company with me. So, you know, we were super lean. We just didn't feel that were steady enough on our feet that we wanted to be responsible for anybody yet at the time. And we also knew that because I wasn't making them myself anymore, that we could handle sort of the business aspects of things. And I won't say that it wasn't tough to overcome. It was a lot of work, but we managed it. And I think we're getting to the point now where we realize that we're not moving forward on some projects because we're both doing the day-to-day stuff and dealing with putting out fires of, you know, oh, this didn't arrive on time or that's not going to be made in time. We're dealing with that all day long, and so we can't move forward on anything else. So it was time to bring someone in because the investment of that is going to pay tenfold. And my old roommate, Jill, was an excellent person to hire because she intimately knows our story. I mean, she was there on the stoop. She can help us with our voice and is super talented with e-commerce and all of all sorts of things in terms of like dealing with corporate culture. And she's just had a lot more corporate experience than we both did. Sure. In our sort of unorthodox odd job sort of life. And she built our whole e-commerce site and has really pushed us to the next level where we wanted to go. So it was a great hire for us. And now we're just sort of working together and trying to tackle those larger projects.
Did you spend any time in this process thinking about, you know, marketing, even in the abstract, like what your image was as a brand? Or did you really just focus on the product itself?
We did. When we first started with Starbucks, we hired a PR firm. That was, I would say, for us, the most, what we thought was the most superfluous spending that we were going to spend. But in the end, it ended up being really important for us because Starbucks is such a huge thing and news just happens. You know, if something happens in Starbucks, you're going to get written up about it. But we wouldn't be able to contribute our own version of our story and mm-hmm. who we are and what we believe. So we really felt that was important. So we had PR for a while to really help us make sure that our story and who we were and what we believed in for our product was told accurately. And that was really a great way to do that. And they also helped us sort of define what our image was, even though, you know, you may think you know everything about your product, you don't think about those kind of weird details about like, well, if your product was a, you know, fictional character, who would it be? Is it fun or is it, you know, cute or, you know, what are you? And those things don't seem that important. But then when you're trying to figure out how to do Instagram and mm-hmm. Facebook and all those things, they become really important.
Are you sick of hearing the word Pop-Tart?
No, I mean, I think people associate it with that. We don't say those words, but I think that's why they resonated with people. Now, we're obviously never going to compete with that kind of business. Those are iconic. You can get a million of them for, you know, not that much money, and they're delicious. I mean, people love them and have a really strong association with them, but I think that's partially why this product was really popular with people is that it was a different take on it. It was something that was much more like fresh baked at home. It tastes like butter. It tastes like fruit. And it reminds them of that childhood treat. So I think, you know, I think it's a nice symbiosis.
Do you think Brooklyn is part of your brand?
Yeah, definitely in the beginning it was. We don't put it on our packaging or anything. And I don't know that if you live in North Dakota and you go to a Starbucks, you know that we are from Brooklyn unless you turn it over and read our story. So I don't know how much it resonates beyond sort of the people who really care about Brooklyn. But we strongly associate with Brooklyn. I mean, that selling on our stoop couldn't have happened anywhere else. I don't really know where else that would have
Yeah, and
grown
not just the stoop,
business.
You were in Smorgasburg too, which has become
yeah,
a bit of an institution.
Exactly.
Did you feel part of a community in Brooklyn or especially
yeah.
Brooklyn food?
Yes. In the beginning, yeah, because I worked with Anarchy in a Jar and she was definitely part of the community. And then now I would say more so because we have a group of people who meet that are all suites focused businesses in Brooklyn. So we meet once every 2 months and just talk about business and are able to help each other out. Like, oh, vanilla.
So there
prices.
Is a secret cabal of amazing hipster baked goods that happens in Brooklyn.
This is
confirming lots of people's suspicions,
there
right?
There is. Yeah, exactly. Surprisingly, we're all way old and not hipstery, but, you know, I'm sure from the outside people are like, ooh, those businesses, they're so cool. But yeah, no. But we all meet together once every 2 months, and it's great because no one else knows what you're going through except for people who are going through that. So we all have very different businesses. Some have brick and mortar bakeries, some have ice cream companies, but surprisingly we do hit on a lot of the same issues all the time. Health insurance for your workers, how do you deal with like the rising cost of vanilla, how do you deal with PR, or how do you know, all of those things are things that we can kind of answer for each other. And we have an email chain if anybody has a question. And then I'm also just started being a part of another group that is other Brooklyn businesses of all stripes, meeting together once a month that sort of learn about how to become better leaders, not only in our field, but just in general. So that's been so helpful. And I really don't know what I would have done if I hadn't been able to join groups like that, because you're just out there alone and it feels like no one else can help you, or you can't help anybody else. And it just feels a little bit isolating.
Amazing. Well, Meg, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to From Day One, How Brooklyn Entrepreneurs Got Their Start. This series is made possible by a grant from the Made in New York Media Center in conjunction with The Bridge, a new site dedicated to reporting on business in Brooklyn. For more from The Bridge, learn more about today's guest, or to listen to more episodes of From Day One, visit us at thebridgebk.com. That's thebridgebk.com. From Day One is produced by Kim Thornton, Steve Kep, and myself, Nick Bailey. Audio editing and post-production by Al Sigmund. From Day One logo was created by Joe Meyer, and our theme music was performed by Jody Rockwell and The Ambulance. Thanks for listening.